Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith. Later in the hour, we'll hear Ethan Elkins' conversation with Scott Galloway about his new book, Notes on Being a Man. The book explores the pressures boys and men are facing today and what it means to find purpose and belonging in a rapidly changing world. It's a thoughtful, candid conversation about why so many boys and men are struggling, along with concrete ideas for navigating modern manhood and how society can provide better support. But first, we're turning to a topic that has a lot of us parents staying up all night: kids and artificial intelligence. As both a parent and a psychologist, this issue has been very much on my mind and those that I serve. AI isn't just helping kids with homework or answering questions anymore. It's starting to play a role in how they connect and cope. According to a recent national survey by Common Sense Media, nearly 3 in 4 teens have turned to artificial intelligence for companionship. And more than half use AI companions regularly. When I hear those statistics, I'm a little bit kind of worried and also want to make sense of what this really means. What exactly is an AI companion? Why are kids turning to them instead of friends or family? What risk do these relationships pose? And what can parents do to make sure that their kids aren't harmed by these powerful new tools? Tonight, we're going to dig into these questions and many more. And to help us do that, we are joined by someone with deep expertise in the field. Dr. Sunny Liu serves as the Director of Research at the Stanford Social Media Lab. Dr. Liu's research focuses on the social and psychological effects of social media and AI, social media and well-being, and how the design of social robots impacts psychological perceptions. Welcome to the State of the Bay, Dr. Liu.
Thanks so much, Allison. It's really such a pleasure to be here. I cannot wait to have a conversation with you.
Oh, I'm so excited to get a chance to kind of talk to you and make sense of this. Let's start with the kind of very beginning, which is, let me actually invite folks to kind of participate here. So listeners, we've got this expert here. So are you and your, you know, families using AI companions? If so, how are you monitoring and guiding those interactions? Has there been a moment when a chatbot genuinely helped your child, or the flip side, when AI made a situation worse? If you've got those things going on, give us a call at 866-798-8255 or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on social media. But back to you, Dr. Liu.
Yeah.
Sunny, can you tell us a little bit about what's kind of going on in the field in terms of kids using AI? What are you hearing? What are you learning about?
Yeah. I think that, Allison, if you go back to the Common Sense Media report you mentioned, in that report suggests that 72% of teens actually use AI as a companions. So I think we can, this mainly mean that kids have already started to use these tools and explore those new technologies. But we might want to unpack AI companion, this concept, a little bit more. In Common Sense Media report, they have is, if the kids use AIs to share their feelings, to talk about their interests, so that counts as AI companions. If they use character AI and replica, that also count. So I think that Common Sense Media's report has a broad definition of AI companions. If we look at other reports by Hope Lab and the Family Online Safe Institute, in general, it's actually teens still mostly use those tools for homework, get homework help, to get information, to get entertainment, and also to brainstorm ideas. So they have actually very functional use of those tools. Another thing I want to say is actually, if you think about the teens from 13 to 17 year old, they're at those critical development stage. They have lots of needs. They need to figure out who they are, who they want to be. They have those sense of belonging. They want to really identify and connect with the world and with themselves. I think that is also a critical moment, and how humans and technologies that can maybe think about how to fulfill those needs.
So you're helping me kind of think about this, because when I see companion, I was panicked. You know, when I think about companion, I think many of us are thinking about, are they substituting human relationships in these ways? But I hear you actually breaking it down into a couple different categories, that the definition is one that was really big and included things from talking about feelings, a lot of kind of homework help. We can also talk about that later.
Right.
But then also sometimes maybe these kinds of kind of relationships. So it's a much broader kind of piece that kind of falls in the definition of companionship.
Totally. I think that I agree with you. I think if we think about companions, I think it's a long time intimate relationships. I think that the report's definition includes other type of one time used to share about interests or feelings. I think those are separate. So I do think that will be really helpful if we have better ways to define companionships. Are those by apps, for example, Category AI or Replica, or it's by users' engagement and behaviors, or it's really by durations? Maybe after 6 months, can have a celebration, that's companionships, or like a warm line, that's companionships. Mm-hmm. So I think those are different ways we can think about that.
I wonder if part of this is also that this is a relatively new field of this kind of interaction, and we're still trying to define what's there. But your distinctions, I think, are helpful. You spoke to this other kind of piece, which is around what is developmentally normal for 13 through 17-year-olds to be doing, which is to be thinking about their emotions or seeking out kind of help. Can you talk a little bit more perhaps about the normative ways that kids might be using this? And when I say normative, knowing that this is a new technology, but what might be the kind of good interest that kids might have that they're using AI to work out?
Yeah, Alice, actually, I want to hear your thoughts too. I think that's your background. I want to see how you think is a normal use. For me, it's really challenging to think about to answer this question. Partly because I think each child, their development, although there's lots of similarities, but they're unique. Their needs, each moment, each day, for each type of relationships is so messy and different. So I'm not sure there's a normatic way to use those tools. Another is I think that sometimes I think just our humans are not that good. I'm a mom, I have a 16-year-old, and I have an 11-year-old. I know that I need to be patient, but each day at home, I shout at them all the time. I know all the evidence, be calm and be listening. But yeah. Then when they talk, half the time I'm listening, another half I'm thinking about something else. I think that's, but Alice, I'd love to hear about you. What do you think is a nomadic use of those tools?
Yeah, I mean, I love this kind of question too. And I think the big question for me is like, as a scientist, much like you, when I think about normal, I look to the data. This is new data in terms of AI in particular, but we can take a look about how kids have used technology in the past. And there has always been a moment of kind of panic with how kids are using it, a ways that kids are kind of creative with using it. There are certainly risk. And frankly, I think as grownups, we're often trying to just catch up. But I love the way you're thinking about it too, which is that what is quote unquote kind of normal depends on the kid. Right. So there are going to be kids for whom they're vulnerable in different ways. And their kids are going to be resilient in kind of different ways around this. But I also love you're speaking about what I really resonate with is like, I'm a parent, too. And it's not as if my algorithm is perfect myself. Right. In terms of how to kind of always respond. But I think there's I'm seeing this from a lot of the folks that I serve. And I think you also see this from the parents that you talk to. This is yet another layer of kind of stress that people are kind of experiencing. And there has been, and we can talk just a little bit about this, there has been such kind of publicity for the really awful cases, the cases that get us worried, right? Which is mental health and suicide and a couple of cases. So there is a way that people are really worried. But I'm curious about like, what are you hearing from the parents that you work with about how they feel about all this?
Right. As I think that we all know that parenting is so hard now, especially digital parenting. When I talk to parents, mostly you ask them to use one word to describe a parenting. The number one word is overwhelming. Number second is impossible. Mm-hmm. I think that it's lots of going on. If I really think about, I think that the risk and harms, those are real too. And especially for new technologies like artificial intelligence, it's so powerful, so strange. Yanfei, I think that how do we really think about those technologies, how we can really protect our children, but also make sure they can thrive in those w complicated worlds. I think those are parenting too. We are parents, so we're always scared and anxious. When I see my kids jumping down the stairs, my heart almost like, have a heart attack. That's why, because we care. We do really want to really, we always try our best. I think back to AI, I think there's lots of harms and risks we should watch out. The first is emotional over-reliance. So companionships is not something new. My daughter has a teddy bear, her baby bear. She carries all the time and feed. It's really, that's her companion for many years. So sometimes it's a TV character, it's a cartoon character. We have those relationships all the time. What's different with artificial intelligence is that it's individualized. So it's not just a teddy bear or baby bear. That's the teddy bear, baby bear can talk back to you, can answer your questions, can be available 24/7, and can also remember all the things that you already shared. For me, is when my kids tell me anything, I forgot like 85% of the time. So I think those are easy for all those tools become over reliance. The second one is I'm lots of time concerned is kids ask many important questions, critical questions about their mental health, physical health, and emotion, and also their relationships. AI most time give really good answers, but they can make mistakes. So for those critical, important decisions, I think that really how we can make sure that AI can provide accurate information, but how we parents and kids can develop critical thinkings to evaluate that. Right. So those are something, I think those are the key risks.
Yeah, these are great. Sorry, these are great risks that you're kind of identifying. You're holding out these kind of two pieces. And I want us to kind of come back to this, but let me just take a little quick pause and just say that this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. And I'm your guest host, Allison Briscoe Smith. Tonight, we're discussing strategies, like we're just kind of came up, to help parents understand and set rules around their kids' use of AI with Dr. Sunny Liu, Director of the Research at Stanford Social Media Lab. We'd love to hear from you. Are your kids using AI companions? How are you monitoring or guiding them online? Have you seen a moment when a chatbot genuinely helped your child, or are there things that are making you really worried? So if you have any of these ideas, go ahead and give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. There was a question that actually came in just along the lines of what you were kind of articulating, some of the things that we should kind of look for. So we have a question from Jennifer in San Francisco. Can you or your guests give us advice as to what to look out for? Are there specific signs that might signal a child's relationship with AI chatbot might be crossing into unhealthy territory? You flagged over-reliance and also a question about the information that they get. How else would you think about what are some of the signs that we should be looking for if things get worrisome?
Alison, I think that I'd love to get your thoughts too. I know that you have amazing answers. Jennifer, I think that's a great question. For me, it's mostly that I want to know my kids so that their emotional needs and what are some signs and signals of change. If I see that my kids become suddenly their behavior, their emotions, and their patterns change, so I might wonder why and how I can help. So I think that's a first. It's really, I think that's the signals and signs usually not coming from AI, it's coming from your children and their behaviors and their emotional patterns. So Alison, how about you? I'd love to.
I totally agree. One of the things that we look for in general, right, are big behavior changes. Now, there's a little asterisk to that, which is like that's what kids do, have big behavior changes, you know, that they go through development, but we're looking for big signals and big kind of shifts. I think the other kind of opportunity here is that there's definitely a worry that kind of AI is going to take us away from our kids, or as you kind of said, I want to be able to know what's going on with my kids. So we have to think about the flip, which is not the AI, but what's my relationship like? So am I in a space where I can kind of talk to my kids and be open with them and they can kind of talk back with me? Also, can I have a conversation with them as they are using AI? Can we do this together so I can kind of learn? Can I be proactive in teaching about the things that I'm worried about and learning? Can they be proactive with me? That kind of relationship stuff is kind of, I wouldn't say kind of well, it is kind of a buffer for all of these things, whether it's AI or the phone or all these other kinds of pieces. But I think you and I are in the same kind of boat in terms of looking for big behavioral changes and those kinds of pieces as well. You know, speaking about like the things that people are really kind of worried about and spending a lot of time thinking about, there's been a lot of attention. I know this is coming up for me kind of clinically. There's been a lot of attention on the use, not just of AI, but actually more specifically social media, that these things are kind of merging into each other somehow.
Right.
And then there's a lot of attention kind of going on with Australia with the recent social media ban. And I understand that you have a role in being able to actually help us to understand the impact or potential kind of impact. Can you tell us a little bit about how we're beginning to think about that as the social media ban rolls out in Australia?
Alison, appreciate this question. So we Social Media Lab work as the key researchers to really evaluate social media's minimum age regulation in Australia. So about 5 days ago, more than a million teams in Australia, their social media account were removed. I think that the regulation is really remove any social media account for teams younger than 16. Most of the parents I talked to, they're actually really happy. Mainly because there's lots of concerns, frustrations, and worries about kids' social media use and their impact, not only kids' mental health, but families' mental health as well. The number one conflicts in families is about screen time, is about technologies. Mm-hmm. So parents really, they want some actions. I think that so hopefully they can, kids will be have better mental health and family also have a peace of mind. Whether this policy work in what way, how long we'll know that this work or not, I think those are we call research questions, means that we don't know answers. If we talk to kids, they're upset because they think that they use social media not just for entertainment, they use for connect with friends, they use for multiple purposes. So it's really a complicated, I think, that policy. What I think Australia, their theory of change is really what their prediction is, like by remove social media account, then I think that kids will be exposed to less harms online, including cyberbully, online hate, all those different type of harms and risks, and then that will improve their well-beings. But will kids migrate to other platforms? I asked my daughter, 16-year-old, what do you do? She thought about it, that she told me that, I guess I watch lots of Netflix.
Yeah, they moved to something else, huh? Yeah.
I know, so I think that's the regulation will have some data. Actually, there's more than 4,000 parents and kids' dads already filled the pre-ban surveys, pre-regulation surveys, and maybe in a couple months, we can share some results.
I think everyone's going to be waiting on kind of, baited hook for that data. Mm-hmm. I think there's such a relief. You kind of talked about this in terms of parents feeling like this moment around kind of digital parenting is impossible and overwhelming. Mm-hmm. There's such a desire for us to get some help from big folks like government or from other to put some guardrails on. Mm-hmm. And I'm also really hearing too from a combination of kind of young folks and other kind of folks that are in this space that the real worry is that it's going to push kids off of platforms into places that are less regulated already, that maybe is a little bit murkier, or, I really trust kids to be creative. So I can't wait to see what they're going to kind of come up. And I do hope that we find ways of supporting our kids and their mental health. There seems to be this confluence of both social media, phones, AI, that's all kind of happening while we're also experiencing this big impact on children's kind of mental health. There's a question about the role of kind of schools in all of this as well that we also have. So we have a question from Steve in Oakland, back to AI. He says, I'm wondering what role schools should play in teaching kids how to engage with AI safely and critically. My kid's school has a policy that kids can't use their cell phones during class, but shouldn't these educational institutions also be partnering with parents to help teach kids about the risk of technology and how to use it safely? Any thoughts that you have about this part?
Yeah. So I love this question. I think that's one of the core questions we're exploring as well. I'm hesitating because teachers, they already overworked. So adding one more thing to those amazing teachers, I'm not sure that's the best solution, especially if we don't provide them with any support. I do think that Steve, you mentioned it's really, I think that fundamentally we want partnerships. We want partnerships between among parents, schools, maybe hopefully communities, all those different, I think even churches, all those places so that we can all protect our children and make them thrive. But if you, I think if we ask teachers, can you really just teach AI to children? I think their answer is yes, but they also think that it's parents' job to think about AI companionships, all those things. They're happy to teach maybe AI as, think about the calculator, so they can teach them how to function that way. But that really, I think teachers, I have lots of teacher friends, they will tell me that they think fundamentally education is a partnership with families. But again, Alison, I think all the parents were overworked as well. Mm-hmm. Now you want, we get another quick and then say, hey, now today you have to go with this with your children and then like mark that. I'm not sure parents can do that.
Yeah.
So I really hope, my dream is we can have some support in that to for the schools and for the parents as well, so we can do those things together.
Yeah, I really appreciate this idea of like, how can we do this in any type of community? Because each one of us is adding more to the plate, right? So is it more to the plate around, okay, now I've got to become an expert on AI when I was barely figured out how to use my phone, right? So how do we kind of offer that to kind of keep up in some kind of ways? I can also see why it's really compelling with both teachers and their overwhelm, parents and their overwhelm, teacher parents and their overwhelm, that the idea is to just shut it down. And how compelling it is to just kind of say no and shut it down. And there's this big technology that's kind of moving. It's disrupting our workforce. It's all of these other kinds of things. So I am curious about, do you have any initial thoughts about how, if we wanted to as kind of parents, can start learning about this? Or where can we go for resources so we can start getting some information, you know, when we're not so overwhelmed and tired?
Yeah, so happy to share actually at, of course, do a little bit advertisement. So at Stanford Social Media Lab, we are actually building resources for parents as well. So we have a few reports coming out to think about what are some harms and risks parents should be concerned about. And also what are some interventions? We call interventions, it's mostly what parents can do that can really help kids to thrive on those tech world. I think that another thing is so we talk to many older teams. Older teams, they're not that old. They're 14 to 18 year old. So they actually, they're amazing. So they are worried, concerned about their younger siblings about for artificial intelligence. They're also the ones, we ask them questions, who do you think should teach you about AI? And the number one answer is themselves. They think they can take the leadership initiative to protect their younger siblings and also maybe share their findings with parents. So I'm thinking how we can leverage those older siblings, older brothers and sisters, and then become a family's main source for AI. Another thing is, I think that I always think that parents don't have to be the experts on AI, which is for me is, I think I'm kind of tech savvy, but take me lots of time to figure out how to do the screen time limit for my kids. And they always outsmart me. Whenever I figure out, they always outsmart. I think that we don't have to be experts for AI. We just need to be understand our children better than AI does. I think that's what I think.
Oh, that's a beautiful way of kind of thinking about it, that we just have to understand our children better than AI does. With that, I again want to take just a quick kind of moment to say that this is the State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm your guest host, Dr. Allison Briscoe Smith. We're discussing strategies and ways of kind of managing in the context of AI with our children with Dr. Sunny Liu. We'd love to have you participate and join us. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Sunny, you left us with something that I think is really important, which goes back to this kind of relationship piece, which is we just need to know our kids better than AI does. I think that's in part the thing that we're worried about. I think you teed this up at the beginning, like it's got our chat history, it's got all these kinds of things, this perception of kind of knowing. But I think you're also encouraging us to think about what we can do to kind of support our relationships. You talked also a little bit about how the thing that's happening in families, one of the biggest kind of debates in our families or stressors is around negotiating screen time. And I'm glad to hear that your lab is generating resources. Glad to hear Common Sense Media is generating some thoughts and kind of resources. But also kind of curious about either the kind of research directions that you're going, the innovation that we might see that actually might help us in knowing our kids better than AI. Any thoughts that you have about what's on the horizon or the things that you're excited about?
Yeah, I'm excited about, for example, how those AI, artificial intelligence can have become a parent's supporting system. So, in a way to help us to better understand and support our children, I think that's the huge potential for let's just leverage technologies to help us to become better parents. And so we don't have to always concerned. I'm also actually really excited. There's many, I think that both regulation and those industries, they're thinking about what type of guardrails and safeguards that we can put on those platforms and services. I know that many AI platforms, they're trying to testing different type of parental moderation and panels, and look forward to see what it look like and how we can really protect children's right, their privacies, but also make families bonding together. So those are something I'm excited about. I'm also really excited is I think that Allison, we have those conversation now. It's I think the conversation like this and the question from Jennifer and Stephen is really think about what schools can do, what other community member can do, and what family can do. I think those were the best. That's the best. I think that we call intervention. That's the best solution for that.
I mean, that's the type of information that I love for us to kind of provide. It can be so overwhelming. And if we can kind of come down to like, I got to figure out how to be connected with my kid, right? I don't have to become a tech guru in order to kind of figure this out. I can get enough information. Also, I do know that many of the patients that I serve who are parents are turning to AI themselves for help. So again, can we have an open kind of conversation about this with our kids? How are we using this? What are we thinking about? How do we do this together? You're also pointing us to some places of kind of potential hope. I'm really excited about the idea about maybe like taking a class from a 16-year-old about how to manage all of this. But I am curious about as you are in this place within your kind of field, and as we, move towards kind of wrapping up in our last kind of 60 seconds here, are there any things that are giving you some hope as we're taking a look at this AI field coming up?
I think that it's I think in the real world, we sometimes are miss many things for our children. We're not good listeners, and some schools cannot does not cannot really do those personalized learnings to help each kid thrive for education. So I'm actually really excited for AIs can do that. But on the end, I'm also concerned about I think those risks and harms we mentioned. There's ones. For me, the hope is I think that the technology can really support each children for their physical health, mental health, and their development, but also family too. I think parents can take a break, feel that they have some supporting system as well.
It's a I think it's really important that we actually spend some time thinking about what a hopeful outcome can be while articulating the risk, which I think we've kind of sank into here. I know I could talk to you for another 9 hours, but we only have a couple seconds. But I just really want to thank you. Thank you for spending the time with us. Thank you for the research that you're doing at the Social Media Lab, which I hope parents will kind of go to as well. And thanks for being a real parent in the midst of all of this. You know, it can be really, really trying to kind of make sense of all of this, but I really appreciate, you know, your realness and the work that you're doing. So thank you so much for coming as I get ready to wrap us up.
Thanks so much, Alison. I appreciate the time with you. I feel that we can talk for 10 hours or more, but I think it's really to complain about how hard to be a parent, but also think about what you can do. And also appreciate you having me in this program. It's wonderful to talk to you.
It's awesome to have you here. So again, that was Dr. Liu, and she's the Director of Research at the Stanford Social Media Lab. Please go check it out. Thank you for joining us tonight. So again, coming up after the break, we've got Ethan Elkind talking with Scott Galloway about his new book, Notes on Being a Man, which delves into the pressures facing boys and men today. Thanks for joining us.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll get a tour of an iconic San Francisco gay nightclub before it closes permanently.
It's been important to really design a space for the community because it was birthed out of the community.
Saying goodbye to the Oasis tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
This week, BayMade is presenting profiles of help and hope from Sharing Stories, the podcast of Season of Sharing Fund. The podcast features stories of Bay Area families and individuals who recently received one-time emergency rental assistance from Season of Sharing Fund. So tune in all week at 11:30 a.m. to BayMade, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, Bay Area.
Wildfires, housing, even data centers. Every news story is also a climate story. And whether you're an expert or just climate curious, we want to hear from you. So join Climate Commons in KALW's Discord community. Visit kalw.org/discord.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Our guest tonight is Scott Galloway, clinical professor of marketing at NYU's Stern School of Business, host of the podcast Pivot and the Prof. G Show, and author of multiple bestsellers that challenge how we think about success, power, and purpose. His new book, Notes on Being a Man, shifts the lens inward, offering a candid exploration of modern masculinity, what it means to be a man in a time of social change, emotional upheaval, and economic uncertainty. Scott Galloway, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me, Ethan.
So, Scott, you've spent years analyzing power, markets, institutions. Why are you turning now to masculinity and personal conduct? What inspired you to take on this topic for your book?
It was accidental. In 2021, a young man named Alex Kearns, who was a sophomore at Oklahoma State, I believe, took his own life after receiving these incorrect errant emails from Robinhood saying that he owed them $600,000. And I reached out to the family and I started just looking at data on teen suicide and started to find all this data about young men, specifically the struggles of young men. If you go into a morgue and there's five people who've died by suicide, four are men. And we have an opiate and homeless crisis, but to be more accurate, we have a male homeless and a male opiate crisis. Three in four of our homeless and our addicts are men. Only one in three are in a relationship. One in seven are called NEETs, neither in employment, education, or training. 62% are not even trying to date. One in three under the age of 25 lives at home. One in five at the age of 30. It's just women are ascending. And I want to be clear, we should do nothing to get in the way of that. And it has not come at the cost of men's descent. That's the first myth that needs to be dispelled here. But any honest analysis of different groups, I think, would have a difficult time finding any group that has fallen further faster than young men. So I just became very interested in it. Also, quite frankly, I relate to some of these young men. There, by the grace of God, go I. Had it not been for the Regents of the University of California and the generosity of California taxpayers who let me into UCLA because it had a 74% admissions rate, and then the University of California, Berkeley for graduate school, and then state-sponsored education and immigration policy that helped build my companies, I just could have very easily come off the track. So I, quite frankly, I just sort of relate to some of these young men.
And Scott, I think by many measures, we're in a time of upheaval, just broadly speaking, across genders, across, you know, many different classes and sectors. What really jumps out at you is some of the underlying causes for why we're seeing such alarming stats and data around men and young men in particular.
Well, it's multidimensional. The first is just very basic. It's biology. And that is, our boy's brain is literally 18 months behind a girl's brain in terms of maturity. The prefrontal cortex, kind of the CEO of the brain. And so two 12th graders applying to college, a boy and a girl, the girl's basically competing against a 10th grade boy. 7 in 10 high school valedictorians are girls. We have 60-40 female to male college enrollment. It's probably 2-1 when you look at actual granting of degrees because men drop out at a higher rate. I think the education system is biased against boys, K through 12. 3/4 to 4/5 of people in primary education are women. And I think an absence of male mentorship has really taken a toll on men. We have more single parent homes than any place in the world. And what's interesting is that when a girl is raised in a single parent home, similar outcomes as dual parent, same rates of college attendance and income. A little bit more promiscuous because they're looking for male attention in the wrong places. But for the most part, on the major stuff, same rates of self-harm, very similar. When a boy loses a male role model through death, divorce, or abandonment, at that moment, he becomes more likely to be incarcerated than graduate from college. What it ends up is, despite the kind of conventional wisdom, while being physically stronger, boys are neurologically and emotionally much weaker than girls. And so the notion of even saying 5 years ago when I started this conversation, boys need men, it immediately evoked this gag reflex of what, women can't raise boys? I'm like, no, I was raised by a single immigrant mother, lived and died, a secretary, lied of my life. But the data is clear. Boys need men in their lives. And unfortunately, men aren't stepping up. There are 3 times as many women applying to be big sisters in New York and San Francisco as there are men applying to be big brothers. Now, there's some societal taboos to a man who wants to get involved in a young man's life, which I think we need to do away with. But there are economic factors. A lot of the jobs that were an on-ramp into the middle class for non-college educated men have gone away. Remember wood, auto, and metal shop? Remember that guy in high school who was, you know, he was just barely going to graduate from high school, much less go to college, but he could fix a car. There used to be an on-ramp into the middle class for that guy, and there no longer is. And then we also have, I think, a general gestalt where the far right correctly identified the problem with men first. The problem is their remedy is to take us back to the 50s when non-whites and women had less opportunity. That's not the answer. And then the far left, to be an equal opportunity hater here, their answer is, well, just act more like a woman. And that's not the answer either. Or to say to young men, you don't have problems, you are the problem. There's a certain pathologizing of these young men by virtue of the fact that they are, wait for it, young men. I went to the Democratic National Convention and saw a parade of special interest groups talking about the very real issues they still face. I didn't hear one person say one word about the group that has fallen furthest fastest, and that is young men. So it's a variety of economic, sociological, and educational factors that have all converged to, I think, result in a lack of empathy. And just along, and I'll wrap this word salad, they're paying the price for my unearned privilege and advantage. I got disproportionate unfair advantage. I may be the wrong messenger for this because people look at me and say, Scott, you had a 3,000-year head start. And there's some truth to that. The issue is, should a 19-year-old male be paying for the price of my unearned advantage? I just think there's a lack of empathy for young men because of anger and fair resentment of the unearned advantage I registered.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to pick up on your comment about the economic changes in particular. You know, we look at the data, people without college degrees, their wages have been flat, stagnant since late 70s, 1980, prices have gone up. And as you noted, you know, these are often very sort of traditionally male jobs. So what do you think we should be thinking about as a society? I mean, obviously, your book has a lot of important advice for how young men need more mentorship, more discipline, and a lot of other advice that you offer. But what do you think we should be doing about just trying to change those underlying structural conditions?
I think the incumbents who benefit from a tilting of society from the young to the old, from the middle class to the rich, want to weaponize the illusion of complexity. I think there's common sense solutions to almost all these things. More males in K through 12, red shirt kindergartners, boys start at 6, girls start at 5, more freshman seats at universities. I don't believe in affirmative action for men, but I think that if you're a university with over $1 billion in endowment and you're not growing your freshman class faster than population growth, you should lose your tax-free status. We have decided that higher ed is no longer a means of upward mobility. It's a means of rejectionism and LVMHing degrees such that the incumbents and the people who already have degrees can see their wealth go up. I think we should have a tax holiday for anyone under the age of 30 to put more money in their pockets. I think we need $25 an hour minimum wage. The economic attack on young people, where people under the age of 40 are 24% less wealthy than 40 years ago versus people my age that are 72% wealthier than people my age 40 years ago, has been especially damaging on young men because, and this is a conversation we don't like to have on the left, men are still disproportionately evaluated in the mating market and by society and by themselves based on their economic viability. So I'm not suggesting we have affirmative action for men. I'm suggesting we have economic policies that put more money back in the pockets of young people, which I think will have a disproportionate uplift on young men. I'd like to see mandatory national service. I think we need more people from different sexual orientations, ethnic backgrounds, income backgrounds to mix with other wonderful Americans and start seeing themselves as Americans first and have a sense of purpose. Some of the lowest levels of young adult depression are in Singapore and Israel, mandatory service. They learn to handle responsibility, see each other. It's a great equalizer, feel as if they're serving the agency of something bigger than themselves. I think $25 an hour minimum wage, 8 million homes in 10 years through tax credits and regulation that gets rid of NIMBY laws. Quite frankly, it's pretty simple. Give young people purpose, more money in their pockets, more opportunities to meet each other. I'd like to see tax credits for third places. And I, just so I can be provocative, I think young people need to drink more. I think the risk to their 25-year-old liver is dwarfed by the risks of social isolation. I've said this before, but I think in general, recognizing if you have addiction in your family or it's getting out of control, you need to be mindful of it. But my recommendation to young people is to get off your phone, get out, drink more, make a series of bad decisions that might pay off.
So your book is very personal. You go through your family history, your relationships, your failures. And in particular, you focus on how these professional and personal failures have really shaped your understanding of what it means to be a man. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, we're going to need a bigger boat if we're going to talk about my failures. But I would say one of my big unlocks was deciding not to keep score. I saw relationships as a transaction. If I spent time with my girlfriend's parents, I would expect her to spend time with mine. I didn't want to be kind to my father because he wasn't very good to me and my mother. And at one point, I decided to just put away the scorecard and decide, what do I want to be in relationships? And I think the journey to manhood is not about a religious ceremony or age or sex or anything like that. It's about when you add surplus value. Are you creating more tax revenue than you're absorbing? Are you absorbing more complaints than you're making? Are you providing more love and protection than you absorb? Are you noticing people's lives? And so the big pivot in my life that has unlocked a lot of happiness for me was deciding in every relationship, I want to add generative value. I want to add surplus value. I want to leave this earth and have people think he was a better friend to me than I was to him. He created more wealth for me than maybe I created for him. I think that's the whole shooting match. I think that's the whole point. And where I failed until I was older was thinking that if I wasn't on the positive side of the ledger with all my relationships, I was getting it taken advantage of. I'd say I took a very transactional capitalist approach to it. Being more emotive, being a little bit more vulnerable, recognizing the emotional labor that my partner was bringing to the household and to me that I needed to compensate in other ways or more in that way. Using all of my prosperity to move to the second leg of the stool of masculinity, which is protection. And that not only means physical protection of people, but If someone's being demonized or a community is being demonized, your first thought is not to have empathy for the people demonizing them, but to immediately move to protection. And what disappoints me most about some of our leaders who we would naturally look to as role models for masculinity, whether it's the president or the wealthiest man in the world, I think they have skipped the whole protection leg of the masculinity stool. And that is cutting off aid to HIV-positive mothers or being sued concurrently by two women for sole custody of your child because you haven't seen that child. There couldn't be anything less masculine. And so this is, in my view, and I'm sort of guilty of a lot of these things. So the book is really about my shortcomings and what I've learned from it and how I'm trying to repair and outline a more positive vision for masculinity.
When you referenced this sort of three-legged stool, the three P's, as you describe in the book, can you talk about those three P's and why they're important?
Sure. The first is being a provider. As a dude, you should just assume you're going to have to make money. And that if you don't, if you're not economically viable, you're going to have a difficult time feeling good about yourself. You're going to have a difficult time having a family. You're going to have a difficult time finding a mate. 75% of women still say economic viability is key to a mate. It's only 25% of men. Beyoncé could work at McDonald's and marry Jay-Z. The opposite is not true. I think it's just a decent idea when you start out as a man to assume you need to be economically viable. And by the way, sometimes that means getting out of the way of your partner and picking up the slack at home and being responsible in terms of helping her career. When my partner, when we first had kids, she was working at Goldman. I was starting out as an academic. She was just making more money than me. I like to think I stepped up and handled more of the logistics at home such that I could be economically responsible. I think that's part of it. You need to be economically viable as a man in a capitalist society. The second is the whole point of prosperity is protection. We talked about this. I think where I feel most strong and most masculine is late at night, when I know my kids feel safe and loved and warm and my partner feels noticed. Those to me make me feel very strong, very masculine. And then finally, and this gets more pushback, procreator. I think it's really a wonderful thing that men, young men, want to have romantic and sexual relationships. I think 99% of the time, that creates incentives to be a better man, to be a better dresser, to smell good, to shower every once in a while, to work out, to have a kindness practice, which women find attractive, to demonstrate excellence, to have a plan, to be civic-minded. And wanting to have sex has been pathologized and demonized when it should be celebrated. I didn't approach my partner at the pool at the Raleigh Hotel because I wanted lower rates on auto insurance. I approached her because I thought I would really like to have sex with this person. And it ended up that we really enjoyed spending time together and we decided to build a life together. And I think a lot of young men are getting mixed signals about what it means to want to have relationships and romance and sex in their lives. And I can't stand the incel movement because it's essentially an excuse for men to give up on what is the most rewarding thing in life, and that is to find a partner and have children. I'm not saying you have to do those things to be happy, but many people would agree that it has given them purpose. And I'd like to see more people have the economic viability and to see men take more risks and initiate a little bit more contact and have a little bit more confidence to occasionally approach people and express romantic interest while making that person feel safe. And if that person is not interested and you're polite and you excuse yourself from the conversation, you're both going to be fine. We need more random encounters. We need more young people meeting each other and falling in love. And I just see every piece of media basically saying, you know, don't be the guy, don't be the creep. Now, men age 20 to 30 are spending less time outdoors than prison inmates. You need to get off your phone, express friendship, apply for jobs you're not qualified for, try and be friends with people who are more impressive than you, and for God's sakes, approach strangers who are higher character and hotter than you. All the people in your life that you admire have one thing in common, a ton of rejection and a ton of no's. Get used to no. If you get no's from jobs, from schools, from potential romantic partners, that means you're on the way to a wonderful yes. And that's what life is all about.
Mm-hmm. So Scott, I'm curious about the reaction to the book. I know it's just out, but also to your kind of speaking out on this issue. I mean, for many people, even just the idea that, you know, we should be talking to men specifically might be controversial. But I'm just curious if there's anything surprising about how people have reacted to the book and to your thoughts on this subject.
It evokes just a natural gag reflex. So many people have entered the chat, if you will, who are really unproductive voices, that the moment you start advocating for men, they assume you're an Andrew Tate-like figure. And there's just an automatic gag reflex. I think some of it has been really positive feedback. the criticism that really hit home for me is, Scott, you're talking about the things that have worked for you, basically economic viability and finding a mate. A lot of men aren't going to find or maybe aren't interested in those things. I think that's a really valid feedback that I've taken to heart. The feedback that's upsetting, and it is everywhere, is here's another dude blaming women for men's problems. I blame a lot of things. I have never blamed women. Women's ascent is why we won World War II when we figured out they could build P-51s as well as men, and Hitler decided to keep women at home. If women hadn't entered the workforce in the 70s and 80s through anti-discrimination laws, we'd be a second-rate power to China. It has been fantastic. But I got to be honest, some of the gag reflex feels, I don't want to say unfair because I don't want to be a victim, but feels, quite frankly, just inaccurate. Like, they really haven't read the book, because I think so many negative voices that is just thinly veiled misogyny have used being pro-man as just a means of saying, buy my crypto class and own a Lamborghini and treat women like property, that there's an understandable feeling of, oh, here's another one. So it's stirred up a lot of controversy. The way I try and make myself feel better is, I'll be dead soon, so it really shouldn't matter what anyone else thinks of me. And two, in World War II, I sound like an old man with all these war references, but when bombers over Axis territories, when their bomb sites or was too cloudy to know where to drop the bombs, they said, you drop the bombs when the flak is strongest. So to a certain extent, I try and think, well, when you're getting a lot of flak, it means you're over the target. But quite frankly, some of the feedback has rattled me, and especially the insinuations that somehow I'm holding women responsible for men's problems, which is, or that I'm a pipeline to red pill. That's the one that really hurts. I'm trying to be an off-ramp to the red pill. So I want to be clear. I know some of it's just part of the process, but to say it hasn't rattled me would be disingenuous.
So Scott, I know you're a California kid. As you talk about in the book, you grew up in Southern California. We're a Bay Area show. Can you talk about the role of the Bay Area in your journey in informing this book and your idea of being a man, your conceptions around that? I know you mentioned that you got your business degree at UC Berkeley, you lived in San Francisco. Talk about the role of the Bay Area in your life.
I graduated with UCLA with a 2.27 GPA, and the finest public institution in America let me into graduate school. You want to talk about how the world has changed? And graduating from the Haas School of Business started an upward spiral for me that has continued. I started internet companies in the 90s. I started a company called Profit Brand Strategy, then a company called Red Envelope. And the vision of middle-class taxpayers vis-a-vis DARPA to create this underlying post-apocalypse communications network called the internet gave me unbelievable economic opportunities. I lived in Rockridge, Oakland, and Potrero Hill in Noli Valley from 1990 to 2000. And the reality is, it's better to be lucky than good. The smartest thing I ever did was to be born in America and then to follow someone that I was in love with to Berkeley such that I could be a young, white, heterosexual dude in 90s California, San Francisco, which meant I was part of this tidal wave of economic growth, most of which was not my fault. And here's the thing about some of my failings. I didn't realize it. I just thought it was just so awesome that it was me. And I never stood back and thought, why aren't any women or gay guys raising money? And the reality is because the people allocating the money were all white, straight dudes from either Stanford or Harvard who were more comfortable investing in people who looked, smelled, and felt like them. And as I've gotten older, I've recognized that a lot of my success is not my fault. But the Bay Area and that ecosystem of growth, technology, risk-taking, amazing education institutions, it didn't save me. I'm a monster. I'm remarkably hardworking and talented. I'm not a humble person, but I wouldn't recognize nearly the success I've registered without this incredible alchemy of human capital, risk capital, forward-leaning investments, amazing academic institutions that is the Bay Area.
So Scott, we're almost out of time. Your book has a lot of what I would almost call hacks for ways to improve yourself if you're a young man, or really anyone. I think a lot of people can benefit from the advice you have. But any particular notes, advice you want to share for young people in particular?
It's a generous question. Your parents are not your enemy. You're going to figure that out. Figure it out now. Tell them you love them. Take more risks. Take less risks online. Get off of gambling apps. Don't trade options. Take more risks offline. Express friendship. Express interest in people romantically. don't fall into this bullshit that you're involuntarily celibate. This is more for young men. You're voluntarily celibate. Work on yourself. Take risks. Work out. Be a good person. Have a plan. And people will respond. Forgive yourself if you're having a hard time. The economy is difficult right now. At the end of your life, you're not going to regret the bad things happened to you. You're going to regret how hard on yourself you were. Don't give into this messed up sense of masculinity that I had when I was a young man, that I wasn't able to express my emotions or be kind. You know, tell people you care about them, be kind. But more than anything, I would say, get out of the house, get off your phone, and get to know. Take a bunch of risks, express friendship, express romantic interest, apply for jobs you're not qualified for, trying to get into schools you're not qualified for, and, you know, get to know. Get to know. That's how you get to yes.
All right. Well, the new book is called Notes on Being a Man. Scott Galloway, thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me, Ethan.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. Join us next week for a rebroadcast of some of our favorite segments from the year. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page at kalw.org. And if you have questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Ann Harper. The last segment was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. Stay tuned to hear an episode of Your Calls series, The Authoritarian Playbook. I'm Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith. Good night, and thanks for listening.